searing tears dissipating on the pavement. Only 1 month ago, Ronan had smoked a Mitsubishi in a far lesser car than the Camaro. There wasn't a reality that permitted Kavinsky's car to possess that sort of performance. The streetlights flickered above them and went out. The Camaro smelled like a furnace. The keys dangled in the ignition, chinking metal against metal. It was slowly dawning on Ronan that he had been badly beaten. This wasn't how it was supposed to end. He'd dreamt the keys, he'd gotten to Camaro, he'd made all the shifts, and Kavinsky had not. I dreamt this.
Now you're done, right? Noah asked. Now you stop?
But the dream was fading away, like they all do, he thought. His joy was dissolving, plastic in acid.
Stop, Noah repeated.
There was nothing left to do but stop. But that was when one of the night horrors landed on the roof of the Camaro. Ronan's first thought was the paint. The pig was a piece of shit, but the paint was beyond reproach. And then one of the claws punched neatly through the windshield. Whether or not it was in a dream or in reality, the night horror wanted the same thing. To kill Ronan.
35.
Ronan! Noah yelled. The road spread out in front of them black and empty. Ronan stepped on the accelerator. The Camaro responded with a churlish and enthusiastic growl. Noah craned his neck.
Not working!
A long splinter was forming in the glass of the windshield with the point of the night horror's claw as its epicenter. Ronan jerked the wheel back and forth. The Camaro skidded violently sideways, the body rolling back and forth. God damn it, Ronan muttered, fighting for control. This was not the BMW. Steering was an imaginary creature.
Still there, Noah reported.
The Camaro shuddered, the rear fishtailing. Ronan's eyes darted to the rearview mirror. A second bird creature clung to the trunk. This was bad. Ronan snapped, "You could help!" Noah fluttered his hands, pressing them on the window crank and then the back of the seat and finally the dash. He clearly didn't want to do whatever he was considering. A squeal raked through the air. It was difficult to tell if it was a nail on metal or the sound of the birdman crying out. It clawed the hair up Ronan's arms.
Noah, man, come on!
Noah vanished. Ronan craned his neck, looking. With a tremendous crack, the bottom right corner of the windshield collapsed onto the dash. A claw snaked in. Noah shouted, "Brake!" Ronan slammed on the brakes. He had too much speed, too much brakes, too little steering. The Camaro swept from side to side as it hurtled on. The steering wheel did nothing. Noah and a flash of black tumbled over the left side of the hood, leaving the windshield suddenly clear. The car kicked up as one of the tires ran over the bundle. There was no time to see where the two of them went because the jolt had unsettled the car. Noah's already dead. He's all right, Ronan thought frantically. And the Camaro was running out of road fast. The smell of rubber and brake filled the car. It was an accident without a collision. The road went left, but the car kept going straight. No. In agonizing detail, Ronan saw the telephone pole just as the passenger door made contact. There was nothing gentle about this sound. It was not at all like the cars colliding at Kavinsky's substance party. This was metal rending, glass shrieking. It was a five-finger metallic punch in Ronan's side. Then it was over. The car was utterly silent. Ronan didn't know if it had stalled or if he had killed it. The passenger side door was buckled in halfway to the gear shift. The glove box door had burst off entirely, and the contents, including Gansey's EpiPen, had exploded throughout the front seat. The realization was slowly dawning that everything had gone to shit. Tick-tick-tick-tick. The second night horror looked at Ronan upside down. It was on the roof, staring through the windshield at him, close enough for Ronan to see each individual scale around its sullen red pupil. With an experimental shove, the creature drummed nails on the windshield. What remained of the glass groaned where it met the car. With just a bit more weight, it would all collapse.
Do something!
Noah was a voice, but nothing more. His energy expended, but the impact had frozen Ronan. His ears rang. The birdman hissed. Ronan knew. He knew what he always did. He'd wanted him dead. In his dreams, it didn't matter, but he wasn't dreaming. The Nightheart's head jerked up as a car slid by the Camaro. It was a sexy, messy, stylish slide, and the car performing it was a white Mitsubishi. The car spun round so the driver's side was illuminated by the pig's headlights. The Night Horror clambered down the windshield. Crouching on the hood, it hissed at the newcomer. The driver's side window of the Mitsubishi slid down. Behind it was Kavinsky, his expression impossible to determine behind his white sunglasses. He leaned to get something from beneath his seat, and then he pointed it at the Night Horror. It took a moment for Ronan to realize what it was. It was a small, imaginary-looking gun, shiny as chrome. Ronan dove down beneath the dash, curled small as he could. Outside of the car, Kavinsky fired the gun. At the first shot, the birdman's hiss stopped abruptly. At the second, its weight slumped audibly against the hood. It didn't move after that. But Kavinsky fired four more times until splatter appeared on the upper few inches of the Camaro's windshield. There was no sound, except for the sly growl of the Mitsubishi's engine. Ronan slowly sat up. Kavinsky still leaned out his window, chrome gun hanging casually from his hand. He seemed to be enjoying himself, or at least seemed to be untroubled. Ronan had to keep reminding himself he was awake, not because he didn't feel awake, but because everything that had just happened felt so acutely like something he would dream. He opened the door. It seemed pointless to stay where he was as the Camaro was clearly headed nowhere, and got out. Standing on the asphalt, he stared at the dead Night Horror draped over the front of the ruined Camaro, and then he stared at Kavinsky.
"Try to keep up, Lynch," Kavinsky said. He withdrew into the car, and for a moment, Ronan was worried that he was leaving. Kavinsky was no ally, but he was human, and he was alive, and he had just saved Ronan's life, and that was something. But Kavinsky was just returning the gun to wherever he'd got it from, and backing the Mitsubishi farther onto the shoulder. He rejoined Ronan beside the Camaro, shoes crunching on grains of glass.
"Well, that's fucked," Kavinsky said approvingly,
and it was. The smooth line Ronan had run his hand along only hours before was now torqued, the metal hugged around the telephone pole. One of the wheels had come free and lay in the ditch several feet away. Even the smell in the air was disaster, chemicals spilling and substances melting. Ronan scraped a hand over the back of his head. He felt like his heart was collapsing inside him. Each wall came down individually, crushing the one before it. "He's going to kill me. God damn it. He's going to kill me." Kavinsky pointed to the Night Horror.
"No, that was going to kill you, man. Ganzi'll forgive you, man. He doesn't want to sleep alone."
All at once, Ronan was done. He seized the straps of Kavinsky's tank top and shoved him.
"Enough already. This isn't your fucking Mitsu. I can't go out and buy another one tomorrow morning."
With a knowing look, Kavinsky unhooked Ronan's fingers. He watched as Ronan pushed off, pacing, hands behind his head, eyes darting down the road to see if any other cars were coming. But there was no fixing this, no matter how Ronan looked at it.
"Look, Lynch," Kavinsky said, "it's simple. Wrap your tiny Celtic brain around this concept. What did your mom do when your goldfish died?"
Ronan stopped pacing. "I told you, it's not your rice rocket. I can get him another, but it won't be the same. He doesn't want another one. He wants this one."
"I'm going to be fucking patient with you," Kavinsky said, "because you've had a head injury. You're not listening to the words I say."
Ronan threw a hand toward the pig.
"This is not a goldfish.
You people are such drama queens. I'm going to pop the trunk, and you're going to scrape that thing into it. And then we're going to take a field trip to Concept Land."
Ronan stared at him mistrustfully.
"Look, you're having a life-changing experience here. Get in the car before I need to get high again."
Ronan had nowhere else to go. He got in the car.
36.
Several hours into the party, Gansey and Adam found themselves in the north wing hallway between the back kitchen stairs and Gansey's old room. Vigorous conversation still murmured up through the floor. Adam wasn't sure of Gansey's situation, but he was aware that he himself was drunk. At least his mouth tasted of champagne, and the world seemed blunted and dark. He had not been drunk before. His father had done all of that for him. They stood side by side on a lush purple Persian runner beside a docile Queen Anne side table covered with hunt-themed knick-knacks. Dim gold versions of Adam and Gansey stood in a crazed black mirror hung on the wall. In the reflection, the ordinarily assured line of Gansey's mouth was twisted into something troubled. He tore the knot of his tie to a rakish angle. "Can you believe," he asked tragically, "that I grew up in a place like this?" Adam did not tell Gansey that he usually couldn't forget. "I wish we could go back tomorrow," Gansey said. "I wish we could drive back and see if Cabe's Water appeared." When he said the word Cabe's Water, Adam's neck spasmed like a sly finger plucked a taut, anxious ligament. Another image tried to work its way through. A blink, and he'd see a man in the corner of his eye, standing behind his shoulder, looking at him in the mirror, sad eyes and a bowler hat. Why not? Adam thought angrily. Why the hell not?
Rex Cordovus. I'm never drinking again.
You're not drunk, said Gansey. It was ginger ale, mostly. Look at our faces in there. We're older than we used to be.
When?
Just a minute ago. We're getting older all the time. Adam, is this what you want? This? He made an elegant, dismissive gesture toward the lower floor, pushing it all away from himself. Adam said, I want to get out of Henrietta. He knew it was cruel to say, even if it was the truth, because of course Gansey would say, I don't.
I know you don't. Look, it's not like I'm trying to...
He was going to say, leave you behind, but that was too much, even with the champagne lapping shores. Gansey laughed terribly. I'm a fish who's forgotten how to breathe in water. But Adam was thinking about the suppressed truth. The two of them were on perpendicular paths, not parallel ones, and eventually they'd have to go different ways. By college, probably. If not college, then after. A tension was building in him, like the one that sometimes haunted him late at night, where he wanted to save Gansey or be Gansey. Gansey turned to him. His breath was all mint leaves and champagne, him and them. He asked, Why did you go to Cabe's Water without me, Adam? Here it was, finally. The truth was a complicated thing. Adam shrugged. No, said Gansey, not that.
I don't know what to tell you.
How about the truth?
I don't know what the truth is.
I just don't believe that, Gansey said. He was starting to use the voice, the Richard Gansey III voice. You don't do something without knowing why.
That whole deal might work on Ronan, Adam replied, but it doesn't work on me.
The Gansey in the mirror laughed humorlessly. Ronan never took my car. He didn't lie to me.
Oh, come on. I didn't lie. Something had to be done or Welk would have had control of the line right now.
Adam cast a hand out in the direction of the stairs back toward the party, toward the singing Latin.
He would be the one hearing that. I did the right thing.
That wasn't the question. The question is, that night, you had to walk right by me to go. It's like you're so keen on being Adam Parrish, Army of One. He was Adam Parrish, Army of One. Gansey, raised by these adoring courtiers, would never be able to understand that. Adam's voice was heating. What do you want me to say, Gansey?
Just tell me why.
I've defended you to Blue and Ronan for weeks now. The idea of his behavior being a topic of conversation infuriated Adam.
If the others have a problem with me, they can take it up with me.
Damn it, Adam, that's not the point either.
The point is, just tell me it's not going to happen again. What's it? Someone doing something you didn't ask for? If you wanted someone you could control, you picked the wrong person. There was a pause, full of the distant ringing of silverware and glasses. Someone laughed, high and delighted. Gansey just sighed. And that sigh was the final straw, because it didn't whisper of pity, it drowned in it. Oh, don't even, snapped Adam. Don't you dare. There was no switch this time, no flip from ordinary to angry, because he'd already been angry. It was already dark, and now it was black. Look at you, Adam. Gansey held up a hand, demonstrating. Exhibit A, Adam Parrish, imposter. Just look. Adam felt stuffed full of the partygoers, their false civility, the glittering lights, the fakery of everything. He struggled for words. That's right. There's Adam. What a mess. What do you reckon he was trying to say when he woke the ley line by himself? I don't know, Ronan. Let's not ask him. How about this, Gansey? It wasn't about you. I was doing what needed to be done. Oh, don't lie to me. There were so many other ways. You weren't doing them. Either you want to find this thing or you don't. There was something brutally freeing about being able to say it out loud, everything he'd been thinking. He shouted, and you don't need him. I do. I'm not going to sit back and let someone else take my shot out of this. Gansey's eyes darted down the hall and back to Adam. That's right, Gansey, don't wake the baby. His voice was very low. Glendower was not yours, Adam. This was mine first. You asked us. Either you meant it or you didn't. You did this. Gansey lightly pressed a finger into Adam's chest. This? I don't think so. Adam seized Gansey's wrist. He wasn't nice about it. The suit was slippery as blood under his fingers. I'm not going to be your minion, Gansey. Was that what you wanted? You want me to help you find him. You let me look my way. Gansey jerked his arm out of Adam's grasp. Again, his eyes darted down the hall and back. You should look at yourself in the mirror. Adam didn't. We do this. We do it as equals, Adam said. Gansey glanced over his shoulder, furtive. His mouth made the shh shape, but not the sound. Oh, what? Adam demanded. You're afraid someone will hear? They'll know everything isn't perfect in the land of Dick Gansey? A dose of reality could only help those people. With a sudden twist, he swept all of the figurines from the Queen Anne table. Foxes in breeches and terriers seized in mid-flight, they all plunged to the floor with a satisfying and diseased smash. He raised his voice. World's ending, folks! Adam, I don't need your wisdom, Gansey, he said. I don't need you to babysit me. I got into Aglenby without you. I got blue without you. I woke the ley line without you. I won't take your pity. Now finally, Gansey was silenced. There was something very remote about his eyes or the set of his lips or the lift of his chin. He didn't say anything else. He just gave a tiny shake to the sleeve Adam had grabbed, letting the wrinkles fall out. His eyebrows were pulled together, as if the action required most of his attention. Then he left Adam standing in the hall. Next to Adam, the mirror reflected both him and the flickering form of a ghost no one but Adam could see. She was screaming, but there was no sound. 37. This was the dream. Sitting in the passenger seat of Joseph Kavinsky's Mitsubishi, the odor of a crash clinging to Ronan's clothing, the white dash lights carving Kavinsky a gaunt and wild face, foully seductive lyrics spitting from the speakers, the vein-covered peaks of Kavinsky's knuckles on the gear shift between them. The smell in the car was sweet and unfamiliar, toxic and pleasant in the way Ronan had always thought marijuana would be before he came to Aglenby. Even the feel of the racing seats was unfamiliar. They held Ronan's shoulders and sucked his legs into the very depths of the car like a trap. Every bump in the road transferred directly to Ronan's bones, sharp and immediate.
A touch of the wheel, and they darted one way or another. It was like a car built to both feed on and produce anxiety. Ronan didn't know if he loved it or hated it. They didn't speak. Ronan didn't know what he would say anyway. It felt like anything could happen. All of his secrets felt dangerously close to the surface. Kavinsky drove out of Henrietta, past Deering, into nowhere. The road turned from four lanes to two, and pure black trees pressed out the dull black sky overhead. Ronan's palms sweated. He watched Kavinsky change gears as he snaked along the back roads. Every time he shifted into the fourth gear, he missed the sweet spot. Couldn't he feel the car hanging when he did?
"My eyes are up here, sweetheart," Kavinsky said. With a dismissive noise, Ronan lay his head back in the seat and looked out into the night.
He could tell where they were now. They were nearly to the fairground where the substance party had been. Tonight the great floodlights were dark. The only evidence of the fairground was when the headlights swept over the bunting. They were only in the light for a moment, like colorless ghosts of flags, and then there was nothing but brush as Kavinsky pulled onto an overgrown gravel track before the fairground. A few yards in, Kavinsky stopped. He looked at Ronan.
"I know what you are."
It was like after the crash, after waking from a dream. Ronan was frozen in the sea, staring back at him. The Mitsubishi charged forward, and the road gave way to a limitless clearing. In the headlights, Ronan saw another white car parked up ahead. As they pulled closer, the lights illuminated a huge spoiler on the trunk and then revealed a portion of a knife graphic on the side. It was another Mitsubishi. For a moment, Ronan thought that it might be the old one somehow, its damage miraculously hidden by the poor light. But then the headlights swung to another car parked beside it. The second car was also white, with a large spoiler. Another Mitsubishi. A knife graphic peeked around the shadowed side. Kavinsky pulled forward another few feet. It brought a third car into focus. A white Mitsubishi. They kept creeping forward, field grass rustling against the low bumper. Another Mitsubishi. Another. Another.
"Goldfish," Kavinsky said.
It wouldn't be the same. But these were the same. Dozens upon dozens. Now Ronan saw that the Mitsubishis were parked at least two deep, of identical cars. Only they were not quite identical. The longer Ronan looked, the more differences he saw. A bigger wing here, a splattered dragon graphic there. Some had strange headlights that spread across their entire fronts. Some had no lights at all, just blank sheet metal where they should have been. Some were slightly taller. Some were slightly longer. Some of the cars had only two doors. Some had none. Kavinsky got to the end of the first uneven row and turned to the next. There had to be more than 100 of them. It wasn't possible. Ronan's hands fisted. He said, "I guess I'm not the only one with recurring dreams." Because, of course, these were from Kavinsky's head. Like the fake licenses, like the leather bands he'd given Ronan, like the incredible substances his friends would travel hours for, like every impossible firework he sent up each year on the 4th, like every forgery he was known for in Henrietta. He was a Grey Warren. Kavinsky hauled up the parking brake. They were a white Mitsubishi in a world of white Mitsubishis. Every thought in Ronan's head was a shard of light gone before he could hold it.
"I told you, man," Kavinsky said. "Simple solution."
Ronan's voice was low. Cars. An entire car. He hadn't even imagined it was possible. He had never even thought to try for more than the Camaro's keys. He'd never thought there was anyone outside of himself and his father.
"No. World," Kavinsky said. "An entire world."
38. After the party had dwindled to nothing, Gansey crept down the back staircase, avoiding his family. He didn't know where Adam was. He was supposed to stay in Gansey's old room, as guests of his mother occupied all of the other spare bedrooms, and he didn't go looking for him. Gansey was meant to sleep on the couch, but there would be no sleep for him tonight. So he quietly went outside to the back garden. With a sigh, he sat on the edge of the concrete fountain. The nuances and wonders of the English garden were many, but most of them were lost after dark. The air was thick with the scent of boxwood, gardenias, and Chinese food. The only flowers he could see were white and drowsy. His soul felt raw and battered inside him. What he needed was to sleep, so this day would be over and he could start a new one. What he needed was to be able to turn off his memories, so that he could stop replaying the fight with Adam. He hates me. What he wanted was to be home, and home wasn't here. He was stretched too thin to consider what was wise or what was not. He called Blue. Hello? He pressed his eyes closed. Just the sound of her voice, the Henrietta lull to it, made him feel uneven and shattered. Hello? She echoed. Did I wake you up? Oh, Gansey. No, you didn't. I had Nino's tonight. Is your thing done with? Gansey lay down, his cheek against the still sun-hot concrete of the fountain bench, and looked out of the midnight garden at the sodium vapor paradise that was Washington, D.C. He held his phone to his other ear. His homesickness devoured him. For now. Sorry for the noise, Blue said. It's a zoo here, like always, and I'm just getting some, yogurt, and I'm... There we go. So, what do you need? He took a deep breath. What do I need? He saw Adam's face again. He replayed his own answers. He didn't know which of them was wrong. Do you think, he began, you could tell me what is happening at your house right now? What? Like what Mom's doing? A large insect buzzed by his ear, coming in like a passenger jet. It kept going, though the flyby was close enough to tickle his skin. Or Persephone, or Calla, or anyone. Just describe it to me. Oh, she said. Her voice had changed a little. He heard a chair scraping on her side of the phone. Well, okay. And she did. Sometimes she spoke with her mouth full, and sometimes she had to pause to answer someone else, but she took her time with the story and gave each of the women in the house full measure. Gansey blinked, slower. The takeout dinner smell had gone away, and all that remained was the heavy, pleasant smell of growing things. That, and Blue's voice on the other end of the phone. Like that? She asked finally. Yes, said Gansey. Thanks. 39. Something strange and chemical was happening to the gray man. Once he'd been stabbed with a screwdriver, Phillips had bright blue handle, and falling in love with Maura Sargent was exactly the same. He hadn't felt a thing when the screwdriver had pierced his side. It hadn't been unbearable when he'd stitched it up as he watched The Last Night on the television by the bed, Harbor Palace Inn and Lodging, local color. No, it had gotten terrible only when the wound had begun to close. When he'd begun to regrow skin where it had been chewed away. Now, the ragged hole in his heart was regrowing out of the scar tissue and he couldn't stop feeling it. He felt it as he installed a new bank of meters in the champagne pogrom. They grinned and winked and chirruped at him. He felt it as he sliced open the soles of his second pair of shoes and retrieved his spending cash from within, the bills ruffled fondly against his hand. He felt it as he tried the doorknob of the Kavinsky's vinyl mansion. The front door swung wide open without resistance. He found a house full of wonders, none of them the Grey Warren. Mrs. Kavinsky lifted her cheeks slowly from the toilet, lashes fluttering blearily, nostrils snotty.
I am a figment of your imagination, he told her. She nodded.
He felt it as he leaned over Ronan Lynch's BMW in the parking lot of Monmouth Manufacturing and checked the VIN number. Ordinary VIN numbers were 17 digits long and indicated what sort of car it was and where the car was made. This BMW's VIN number was only 8 numbers long and corresponded to the date of Neil Lynch's birth. The gray man was senselessly delighted by this.
He felt it when Greenmantle called and railed angrily and anxiously about the length of time that had passed.
Are you listening to me? Greenmantle demanded. Do I need to come there myself?
The gray man replied, Henrietta is a nice little town.
He felt it as he let himself into the rectory of St. Agnes and asked the priest inside if the Lynch brothers had ever confessed anything of note. The priest made a variety of shocked noises as the gray man dragged him across the small laminate counter of the kitchenette and the round breakfast table and through the automatic cat feeder provided for the use of the two rectory cats, Joan and Dimphna.
You are a very sick man, the priest told the gray man. I can find you help.
I think, the gray man said, lowering the priest onto a case of new missiles, I've found some.
He felt it when every single machine in the champagne blight illuminated like a Christmas tree, flashing and wailing and surging for all that they were worth. When it first began, his first thought was, yes. Yes, that is exactly what it feels like. And then he remembered why he was there. The lights flared. The meters surged. The alerts screamed. This was not a test. Slowly, inexorably, the readings drew him out of town, rewarding him with ever stronger results. The gray man felt it even now in the inevitability of this treasure hunt. Every so often the machines would sag, the readings flickering, and then, just as he began to suspect the abnormality had vanished for good, leaving him adrift, the meters would explode in light and sound again, even stronger than before. This was not a test. He was finding the Grey Warren today. He could feel it.
40. At 11 the next morning, Gansey received a series of texts from Ronan. The first was merely a photograph. It was a close-up of a part of Ronan's anatomy that he hadn't seen before. An Irish flag was twist-tied to it. It was not the most grotesque display of nationalism Gansey had ever seen, but it was close. Gansey received the text while in the middle of his mother's tea party. Drugged by the poor sleep on the sofa, numbed by the demure socialization occurring all around him, and haunted by the fight with Adam, he didn't immediately process the possible implications of such a photograph. Understanding was only beginning to prickle when a second text came in. Before you hear it from anyone else, I wrecked the pig. Gansey was suddenly very awake. But don't worry, man. I got it under control. Say hi to your mom for me. In most ways, the timing was lucky, because Gansey had inherited from his mother an extreme distaste of showing the uglier emotions in public. Everyone's face is a mirror, Dick. Endeavor to make them reflect a smile. Receiving the news while surrounded by an audience of fine china and laughing ladies in their 50s bought him time to figure out how to react.
Is everything all right?
Asked the woman across from him. Gansey blinked at her.
Oh, yes, thank you.
There were no circumstances under which he would have answered that question in any other way. Possibly if he'd discovered a family member had died. Possibly if one of his limbs had been separated from his body. Possibly. As he accepted a tray of cucumber sandwiches from the woman on his right to pass to the woman on his left, he wondered if Adam had woken up yet. He suspected Adam wouldn't come down even if he was awake. His mind replayed the image of Adam casting the figurines to the floor. These sandwiches are delightful, said the woman on his right to the woman on his left, or possibly to him. They're from Clarissa's, Gansey said automatically. The cucumbers are local.
Ronan took my car. At that moment, Gansey's memory of Ronan and his filthy smile didn't look very different from Joseph Kavinsky and his matching dirty grin. Gansey had to remind himself that they had very important differences.
Ronan was broken. Ronan was fixable. Ronan had a soul.
I am so pleased with the movement to keep food local, said the woman on his right, possibly to the woman on his left, or maybe to him.
Ronan had charm. It was just buried deep. Very deep.
It tastes fresher, said the woman on his left.
The thing was, Gansey had known what happened on Friday nights when Ronan's BMW had come back smelling of burning brakes and a clutch under duress, and he'd taken the Camaro keys with him when he left for a reason, so this wasn't a surprise.
But really, the advantages are in the reduced fuel and transportation costs, Gansey said, that are passed on to the consumer and to the environment.
But what did he mean, wrecked? Gansey's mind was on overload. He could feel his synapses murdering one another.
One wonders about those trucking jobs that are lost, though, said the woman on the right. Pass the sugar, would you?
Say hi to your mom?
I sort of feel the local infrastructure needed to process and sell the produce will end up with a null-sum job loss, Gansey said. The biggest challenge will be adjusting people's expectations to the seasonality of produce they've come to expect year-round.
Wrecked.
You're probably right, said the woman on his left, though I do love having peaches in winter. I'll take the sugar, too, if you would.
He passed a bowl of lumpy brown sugar cubes from the woman on his right to the woman on his left.
Across the table, Helen was animatedly gesturing to a creamer shaped like a genie's lamp. She looked fresh as a newscaster.
Glancing up, she caught Gansey's eye, and then she tapped the corners of her mouth with her napkin, said something to her conversation partner, and stood up. She pointed at Gansey and gestured toward the door to the kitchen.
Gansey excused himself and joined her in the kitchen. It was the only part of the house that hadn't been renovated in the last 2 decades, and it was always dark and vaguely scented by onions.
Gansey stopped by the espresso machine.
He had an immediate distant memory of his glamorous mother placing a frothing pitcher's thermometer under his tongue to check for fever.
Time felt irrelevant.
The door swung shut behind Helen.
What? He asked in a low voice.
You look like you spent your last joy bill.
He hissed. What does that even mean?
I don't know. I was just trying it out.
Well, it doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. And anyway, I've got plenty of joy bills. Loads, Helen said.
What's happening there on your phone?
A very small joy debit.
His older sister's smile shone brightly.
You see, it does work.
Now, did you or did you not need to get out of that room?
Gansey inclined his head in slight acknowledgement. Gansey's siblings knew each other well.
You're so welcome, Helen said. Let me know if you need me to write a joy check.
I really don't think it works.
Oh, I think it has promise, she replied. Now, if you excuse me, I must get back to Miss Capelli. We were talking about space adaptation syndrome and the Coriolis effect. I just wanted you to know what you're missing.
Missing is a strong term.
Yes. Yes, it is.
She pushed through the swinging door. Gansey stood in the dim, root vegetable-scented kitchen until the door had stopped. Then he called Ronan's number.
Dick, Kavinsky said. Gansey.
Pulling the phone back from his head, Gansey confirmed he had actually dialed the correct number. The screen read Ronan Lynch. He couldn't quite understand how Ronan's phone had ended up in Kavinsky's hands, but stranger things had happened. At least now the text messages made sense.
Dick 3, Kavinsky said. You there?
Joseph, Gansey said pleasantly.
Funny I should hear from you. Saw your car running around last night. It's got half a face now, poor bastard.
Gansey closed his eyes and let out a whisper of a sigh.
Sorry, I didn't hear you, Kavinsky said. Come again. I know, that's what Lynch says.
Gansey set his teeth in a very straight line. Gansey's father, Richard Campbell Gansey II, had also gone to a boarding school, the now defunct Rochester Hall. His father, collector of things, collector of words, collector of money, offered tantalizing stories. In them, Gansey caught glimpses of a utopian community of peers intent on learning, keen with the pursuit of wisdom. This was a school that didn't just teach history. No, it wore the past like a comfortable jacket, beloved for all of its frayed ends. Gansey II described students
Comrades, really, forming bonds of brotherhood that would last for the rest of their lives. It was C.S. Lewis and the Inklings, Yeats and the Abbey Theater, Tolkien and his Kolbatar, Glendower and his poet Iolo Gok, Arthur and his knights. It was a community of scholars just outside of adolescence, a sort of Marvel comic where every hero represented a different arm of the humanities. It was not toilet-papered trees and whispered bribes, front lawn hacky sack and faculty affairs, gifted vodka and stolen cars. It was not Aglinby Academy. Sometimes the difference between that utopia and reality exhausted Gansey. All right now, Gansey said. This was great. You giving this phone back to Ronan at any point? There was silence. It was a slick sort of silence, the sort that would make bystanders turn their heads to note it, same as a loud laugh. Gansey didn't quite care for it.
He's going to have to try harder, Kavinsky said.
I beg your pardon.
That's what Lynch says, too.
Gansey could hear the crooked smile in Kavinsky's voice. He asked, Do you ever think your humor veers too much on the side of prurient?
Men, don't SAT at me. Here's what's up. The Ronan you know is no more. He's having a coming-of-age moment. Hey, Bildungsroman. God damn me! S.A.T. that, dick.
Kavinsky, Gansey said evenly. Where's Ronan?
Right here. Wake up, fuckweasel! It's your girlfriend, Kavinsky said. Sorry, he's totally pissed. Can I take a message?
Gansey had to take a very long minute to compose himself. He discovered on the other side of the minute that he was still too angry to speak.
Dickie, you still there?
I'm here. What do you want? Kavinsky said,
Same thing I always want, to be entertained.
The phone went dead. As Gansey stood there, he suddenly recalled a story about Glendower, one that had always bothered him. Glendower was a legend in most ways. He'd risen in rebellion against the English when every other medieval man his age was giving old age and death the stink eye. He'd united the people, defeated impossible odds, and ridden across Wales on rumors of his magical powers. A lawyer, a soldier, a father, a mystical giant who'd left a permanent footprint. But this story... Some of the Welsh weren't convinced that throwing sticks at their English neighbors would improve Wales's dire straits. In particular, one of Glendower's cousins, a man named Hywel, thought Glendower was out of his lawyerly mind. In the way of most families, he expressed his difference of opinion by raising a small army. This might have put off most princes, but not Glendower. He was a lawyer and, like Gansey, a believer in the power of words. He arranged to meet Hywel alone in a deer park to talk it all over. Gansey was untroubled with the story up to this point. This was the Glendower he'd follow anywhere. Then the two men spotted a deer. Hywel lifted his bow, but instead of shooting the animal, he let the arrow fly at Glendower, who had cleverly worn chainmail beneath his tunic. Gansey would have preferred the story to end here, but it didn't. Instead, unharmed by the arrow and enraged by the betrayal, Glendower pursued Hywel, stabbed him, and finally stuffed Hoel's body inside an oak tree. All the stabbing and stuffing and utter loss of temper seemed rather ignoble. Gansey wished he hadn't ever found the story. There was no unreading it, but now... After hearing Kavinsky's slow laugh on the other end of the line, imagining Ronan drunk in his absence from Henrietta, picturing the Camaro in any state other than how he'd left it, Gansey thought he finally glimpsed understanding. He was at once closer and farther from Glendower than he'd been before. 41. Ronan woke up in a movie theater seat.
Of course, it wasn't really a movie theater. It was just a basement home theater in a big, flimsy suburban mansion. In the light of day, he could see that it was done up with the works. Real movie seats, popcorn machine, ceiling projector, shelf full of action flicks and porn with uninventive titles. He vaguely recalled, with less acuity than a dream, watching an endless video of Saudi Arabian street racing on the big pull-down screen last night. What was he doing? He had no idea what he was doing. He couldn't focus on anything except 100 white Mitsubishis in a field.
He didn't throw up,
Kavinsky noted from his perch two seats away. He held Ronan's phone.
Most people throw up after drinking them much.
Ronan didn't say the truth, which was that he was not a stranger to drinking himself senseless. He didn't say anything at all. He just stared at Kavinsky doing the math. 100 white Mitsubishis, 2 dozen fake IDs, 5 leather bracelets, 2 of us.
Say something, Rain Man, said Kavinsky.
Are there others? Kavinsky shrugged.
Hell if I know.
Is your father one?
Is your father one?
Ronan got up. Kavinsky watched him try all 3 of the insubstantial white doors until he found the bathroom. He shut the door behind himself and peed and splashed water on his face and stared at himself. 100 white Mitsubishis. On the other side of the door, Kavinsky said,
I'm getting bored, man. You want a line?
Ronan didn't answer. He dried his trembling hands, got himself together, and stepped out. He sat against the wall and watched Kavinsky do a line off the top of the popcorn machine. Shook his head again when Kavinsky raised an eyebrow in offering.
You always this talkative after you drink?
Kavinsky asked. What were you doing with my phone?
Calling your mother.
Say something else about my mother, Ronan said easily, and I'll smash your face in. How do you do it? He expected Kavinsky to crack another lewd joke about his mom, but instead he just fixed a gaze on Ronan, his pupils cocaine huge.
So violent. Such a PTSD poster boy. You know how to do it, Kavinsky said. I saw you do it.
Ronan's heart twitched convulsively. It couldn't seem to get used to the secret being the opposite of one. What are you talking about?
Kavinsky leapt to his feet. Your suicide attempt, man. I saw it happen. The gate's right by Proko's window. I saw you wake up and the blood appear. I knew what you were.
That had been months and months and months ago, before the street racing had even begun. All this time, Kavinsky had known all this time. You don't know a damn thing about me, Ronan said. Kavinsky jumped to stand on one of the theater seats. As the furniture rocked beneath him, it sang a little, just a little scrap of a pop song that had been overplayed 2 years before, and Ronan realized it must be a dream thing, too.
Come on, man!
Tell me how you do it, Ronan said. I don't mean just the dreaming. The cars, the IDs, the... He lifted his wrist to indicate the bracelets. The list could have gone on and on. The fireworks, the drugs.
You have to go after what you want, Kavinsky said. You have to know what you want.
Ronan said nothing. Under those parameters, it would be impossible for him. What he wanted was to know what he wanted. Kavinsky's smile was wide.
I'll teach you.
42. Adam was gone. At 2 p.m., Gansey thought he'd waited long enough for Adam. Bracing himself, he knocked on the bedroom door. Then he pushed it open and found the room empty and sterile. Afternoon sun washed over the unfinished silhouettes of old models. He leaned toward the bathroom and called Adam's name, but it was clear there was no one in either room. Gansey's first thought was only mild irritation. He didn't blame Adam for avoiding everything having to do with the tea party, nor was he surprised he was lying low after last night's argument. But now he needed him. If he didn't tell someone about Ronan breaking parts off the car, he was going to self-immolate. But Adam wasn't there. It turned out that Adam wasn't anywhere. He was not in the onion-scented kitchen or the brick-floored library or the small, moldy mudroom.
not stretched on the stiff sofas in the formal living room, nor the voluminous corner couches in the casual family room. He was not holed up in the basement bar, nor wandering in the humid garden outside. Gansey replayed the argument from the night before. It felt worse this time around.
"I can't find Adam," Gansey told Helen. She'd been dozing in an armchair in the upstairs study, but when she saw his face, she sat up without complaint.
"Does he have a cell phone?"
Helen asked. Gansey shook his head and said in a smaller voice, "We fought." He didn't want to have to explain further. Helen nodded. He didn't say anything else.
She helped him look in the trickier places. The cars in the garage. The attic crawl space. The rooftop patio on the east wing. There was no place for him to have gone.
This wasn't a walking neighborhood. The closest coffee shop or retail area or congregation of women in yoga pants was 3 miles away, accessed by busy 4- and 6-lane Northern Virginia streets. They were 2 hours from Henrietta by car. He had to be here, but he wasn't. The entire day felt imaginary. The Camaro news this morning, Adam lost this afternoon, this wasn't happening.
"Dick," Helen said, "do you have any ideas?"
"He doesn't disappear," Gansey replied. "Don't panic."
"I'm not panicking."
Helen looked at her brother.
"Yes, you are."
He called Ronan. "Pick up, pick up. For once, pick up." And he called 300 Fox Way.
"Is Blue there?"
"No."
"Has Adam... Coca-Cola t-shirt called?"
After that, it was no longer only Gansey and Helen. It was Gansey and Helen, Mr. Gansey and Mrs. Gansey, Margot, the housekeeper, and Delano, the neighborhood gate man. It was a discreet call placed to Richard Gansey II's friend at the police department. It was evening plans silently shunted aside. It was a small force of private vehicles canvassing the nearby shaded streets and crowded shopping districts. His father drove a 59 Tatra, a Czech specimen rumored to have once belonged to Fidel Castro, while Gansey cradled his phone in the passenger seat. Despite the air conditioning, his palms sweated. The true Gansey huddled deep inside his body so that he could keep his face composed. He left. He left. He left. At 7 p.m., as the thunderheads began to build over the suburbs and as Richard Gansey II once more circled the beautiful green streets of Georgetown, Gansey's phone rang, an unfamiliar Northern Virginia number. He snatched it up. "Hello?" "Gansey?" And with that, relief melted through him, liquefying his joints. "Jesus, Adam!" Gansey's father was looking at him, so he nodded once. Immediately, his father started looking for a place to pull over.
"I couldn't remember your number," Adam said miserably. He was trying so hard to make his voice sound ordinary that it sounded dreadful. He either didn't or couldn't suppress his Henrietta accent.
"It's going to be all right."
"Where are you?" "I don't know." Then a little quieter to someone else. "Where am I?"
The phone was passed to the other person. Gansey heard the sound of cars rushing by in the background. A woman's voice asked, "Hello. Are you a friend of this kid?"
"Yes."
The woman on the other end of the phone explained how she and her husband had stopped by the side of the interstate.
"It looked like there was a body. No one else was stopping. Are you close by? Can you come get him? We're near exit 7 on 395 South.
Gansey's mind shifted abruptly to adjust his image of Adam's surroundings. They had been nowhere close. It hadn't even occurred to him to look that far away. Richard Gansey II had overheard.
"That's south of the Pentagon. That's got to be 15 miles from here."
Gansey pointed to the road, but his father was already checking the traffic to make a U-turn. When he turned, the evening sun suddenly came full in the windshield, blinding both of them momentarily. As one, they both threw up a hand to block the light.
"We're coming," Gansey told the phone.
"It's going to be all right."
"He might need a doctor."
"Is he hurt?"
The woman paused.
"I don't know."
But it wasn't all right. Adam said absolutely nothing to Gansey, not while curled in the back seat of the car, not while sitting at the kitchen table as Margot brought him coffee, not after standing by the sofa with the phone clutched to his ear, talking to a doctor, one of the Gansey's old family friends. Nothing. He'd always been able to fight for so much longer than anyone else. Finally,
He stood in front of Gansey's parents, chin lifted, but eyes far away, and said, "I'm very sorry for all the trouble."
Later, he fell asleep sitting up on the end of that same sofa. Without any particular discussion, the Gansey family in its entirety moved the conversation to the upstairs study out of earshot. Although several engagements had been canceled and Helen had missed a flight to Colorado that evening, no one had mentioned the inconvenience. And they never would. It was the Gansey way.
"What did the doctor call it?" Mrs. Gansey asked, sitting in the armchair Helen had slept in earlier. In the green light through the verdant lampshade beside her, she looked like Helen, which was to say she looked like Gansey, and also to say she looked a little bit like her husband. All of the Ganseys sort of looked like one another, like a dog that begins to look like its owner, or vice versa.
"Transient global amnesia," Helen replied. She had listened to the phone conversation and following discussion with great interest. Helen very much enjoyed climbing down into other people's lives and muddling about there with a pail and a shovel and possibly one of those old-fashioned striped bathing suits with the legs and arms.
2 to 6 hour episodes. Can't remember anything past the last minute. But the victims, that was Foz's word, not mine, apparently know they're losing time while it's happening.
"That sounds dreadful," said Mrs. Gansey. "Does it get worse?"
Helen doodled on the desk blotter with a 2-inch pencil. "Apparently not. Some people only have one episode, some people get them all the time, like migraines."
"And it's stress-related," Richard Gansey II broke in. Although he didn't know Adam well, his concern ran deep and genuine. Adam was his son's friend, and so he had inherent worth. "Dick, do you know what he might be stressed about?"
It was clear this was a problem that all of the Ganseys were intent on solving before Gansey returned to Henrietta with Adam.
"He just moved out of his parents' house," Gansey said. He had started to say trailer, but he didn't like to think of what his own parents would do with that visual. He thought for a moment and then added, "His father beat him."
"Jesus Christ," his father remarked. Then, "Why do they let these people breed?"
Gansey just looked at his father. For a long moment, nothing was said.
"Richard," his mother chastised.
"Where is he staying now?" his father asked. "With you?"
He couldn't know how much or why this question smarted. Gansey shook his head.
"I tried. He's staying at a room that belongs to St. Agnes, a local church."
"Is it legal? Does he have a car?"
"He'll be 18 in a few months, and no."
"It would be better if he stayed with you," Richard Gansey II observed.
"He won't. He just won't. Adam has to do everything himself. He won't take anything that looks like a handout. He's paying his own way through school. He works 3 jobs.
The other Gansey faces were approving. The family as a whole enjoyed charm and pluck, and this idea of Adam Parrish, self-made man, appealed to them immensely.
"But he has to have a car," Mrs. Gansey said. "That would surely help. Can we not give him a little something to help him get one?"
"He won't take it."
"Oh, surely if we say
he won't take it, I promise you, he will not take it."
They thought for a long moment, during which Helen drew her name in large letters and his father paged through a brief encyclopedia of world pottery and his mother discreetly looked up transient global amnesia on her phone and Gansey contemplated just throwing everything he possessed into the Suburban and driving away as fast as he could. A very small, very selfish voice inside Gansey whispered, "What if you left him here? What if you made him find his own way back? What if he had to call you and apologize for once?"
Finally, Helen said, "What if I gave him my old college car, the crappy one I'm going to donate to that broken car charity if he doesn't want it? He'd be saving me the trouble of arranging the tow."
Gansey frowned. "Which crappy car?"
"Obviously, I would obtain one," Helen replied, drawing a 58-foot yacht on the blotter, "and say it was mine."
The older Ganseys adored the idea. Mrs. Gansey was already on the phone. The collective mood had buoyed with the implementation of this plan. Gansey felt it would take more than a car to relieve Adam's stress, but the truth was that he did need a vehicle. And if Adam really did buy Helen's story, it wouldn't hurt a damn thing. Gansey couldn't shake the image of Adam by the side of the interstate, walking, 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 knowing he was forgetting what he was doing but unable to stop.
unable to remember Gansey's number, even when people did stop to help. I don't need your wisdom, Gansey. So there was nothing he could do about it.
43.
Okay, princess, Kavinsky said, presenting a six-pack to Ronan. Show me what you can do.
They were back in the clearing near the fairgrounds. It was hazy, shimmering, dazed in the heat. This was a place for more dream math. 100 white Mitsubishis? 2 dozen fake licenses? 2 of them. 1 day. 2? 3? Time had no meaning. Days were irrelevant. They marked time with dreams. The first one had been just a pen. Ronan woke in the frosty air conditioning of the passenger seat, his fingers motionless over a slender plastic pen balanced on his chest. As always, he hovered above himself, a paralyzed non-participant in his own life. The speaker thumped out something that sounded good-natured, offensive, and Bulgarian. Biting flies clung hopefully to the exterior of the windshield. Kavinsky wore his white sunglasses because he was awake.
Wow, man! This is a pen!
Taking the pen from beneath Ronan's unprotesting fingers, Kavinsky tried it out on the dashboard. There was something dazzling about his total disregard for his own property.
What's this shit, man? Looks like the Declaration of Independence!
Just as in the dream, the pen wrote everything in a dainty cursive, no matter how the user held it. Kavinsky quickly bored of its single-minded magic. He tapped the pen on Ronan's teeth along with the Bulgarian beat until feeling came back to Ronan's hands and he was able to knock it away. Ronan thought it wasn't bad for a dream object produced on command, but Kavinsky regarded the pen scornfully.
Watch this.
Producing a green pill, he flicked it into his mouth and washed it down with some beer. Pulling off his sunglasses, he pressed his knuckles into one of his eyes, grimacing, then he was asleep. Ronan watched him sleep, head thrown to the side, tapping pulse visible through the skin of his neck. Kavinsky's pulse stopped. And then with a violent start, Kavinsky jerked awake, one of his hands fisted. His mouth cracked into a grin at Ronan's surprise. With a theatric twist of his hand, he presented his dream object. A pen cap. He twitched his fingers until Ronan handed over the dream pen. The cap, of course, fit perfectly. Right size, right color, right sheen to the plastic. And why shouldn't it be perfect? Kavinsky was known for his forgery.
Amateur, Kavinsky said. This is a way to dream back Gansey's balls for him.
Is this going to be a thing? Ronan demanded. He was angry, but not as angry as he would have been before he started drinking. He put his fingers on the door handle, ready to get out. Like, is this going to be what's funny to you? Because I don't want this that bad. I can figure it out myself.
Sure you can, Kavinsky said. He cocked a finger at him. Give him that pen. Write him a little note with it. In fucking George Washington letters. Dear Dick, drive this. XOXO, Ronan Lynch.
Ronan wasn't sure if it was Kavinsky using his real name or the refreshed memory of the ruined pig that did it, but he dropped his hand from the door. Leave Gansey out of this. Kavinsky made a whoo shape with his mouth.
Gladly, Lynch.
Here's the deal. You get your stuff from the same place every time, right?
The forest. Mostly.
Go back there. Don't go anywhere else. Why would you want to go anywhere else? You want to go where your shit's at. That's where you go. You're thinking of what you want before you go to sleep, right? You know it's going to be there in that place. Don't let it know you're there. It'll change on you if you do. You gotta be in and out, Lynch.
In and out, Ronan repeated. It didn't sound like a dream he'd ever had.
Like a motherfucking thief.
Kavinsky revealed another 2 green pills in his hand. One he kept for himself. The other he offered to Ronan.
See you on the other side.
Fall asleep. Yes, you fall asleep.
You are awake, and then you close your eyes, and thoughts press in, and lucidity invades, but then eventually you teeter on the edge of slumber and fall. Ronan did not fall asleep. He swallowed the green pill, and he was thrown into sleep, hurled into it, dashed, wrecked, destroyed into sleep. He rolled onto that shore, a crushed version of himself, his legs gone beneath him. The trees leaned over him. The air grinned. Thief! He had been robbed. In, out. There was the object he had planned to take. Was it? He couldn't tell what it was. The trees wrapped their branches around it. Orphan girl tugged and tugged. In, out. Kavinsky's voice very clear.
Dying's a boring side effect.
Ronan snatched the metal of the thing. Inside him, a ventricle jerked restlessly. Blood poured into his empty atria of his heart. Get out! Screamed orphan girl. His eyelids flashed open.
Welcome back to the land of the living, sailor. Kavinsky leaned over him. Remember, you take the pill, or he'll take you.
Ronan couldn't move. Kavinsky gave his chest a supportive thump of the fist.
You're all right, he said amiably.
He poured some beer into Ronan's unprotesting lips and finished it himself. The sun looked strange outside the windshield, like time had passed or the car had moved.
What the hell do you even have there?
Ronan's arms regained sensation. He held a metal cage with a tiny glass Camaro in it. It bore no resemblance to the boombox he'd planned to take out. It bore only a slightly better resemblance to the actual Camaro. Inside the glass car was an anonymous driver, his facial expression vaguely shocked.
Dear Dick, Kavinsky said.
Drive this! This time Ronan laughed. Kavinsky showed him his own prize, a silver gun with the words Dream Killer engraved on the muzzle.
You didn't sneak in, did you? He said accusingly. Sneak in, sneak out. Get your stuff, get out, before the place notices.
Fucking pill, Ronan said. It's a wonder drug. My mom loves the hell out of these, man. When she starts breaking shit in the house, I grind one of these for her. Put it in her smoothie. You can make a joke there, man. It's easy. Go on. I left it wide open for you. What is your place? Kavinsky set two more green pills on the dash. They danced and jittered along to the beat of the speakers. The song slyly told Ronan,
Arimax, Arimax, Arimax and J.
Kavinsky handed him a beer.
My secret place? You went into my secret place?
Kavinsky howled a laugh.
I knew it!
Fine, don't tell me. You put pills in your mom's drink?
Only when she steals my stuff. She wasn't such a bitch back in Jersey.
Ronan didn't know much about Kavinsky's home life other than the legend everyone knew. His father, rich and powerful and Bulgarian, lived in Jersey where he was possibly a mobster. His mother, tanned and fit and made of non-factory standard parts, lived in the suburban mansion with Kavinsky. This was the story Kavinsky told. That was the legend. The rumor was his mother's nasal septum had been eaten away by cocaine, and his father's patriarchal instinct had died when Kavinsky tried to kill him. With Kavinsky, it had always been hard to say what was real. Now, looking at him holding a fraudulently perfect chrome firearm, it was even harder.
Is it true you tried to kill your father? Ronan asked.
He looked right at Kavinsky when he said it. His unflinching gaze was his second finest weapon after his silence. Kavinsky didn't look away.
I never try to do anything, man. I do when I mean to.
Rumor has it that's why you're here and not Jersey.
He tried to kill me,
Kavinsky replied. His eyes glittered. He had no irises, just black and white. The line of his smile was ugly and lascivious.
And he doesn't always do what he means to. And anyway, I'm harder to kill than that.
You kill your old man?
No, Ronan said. This killed him.
Like father, like son, Kavinsky noted.
You ready to go again?
Ronan was. pills on tongue. Chase it with beer. This time he saw the ground coming, like being spat from the air. He had time to hold his thought, hold his breath, curl his body. He rolled into the dream, fast, tossed from a moving vehicle. Soundlessly he rolled into the trees. They watched each other. A strange bird screamed. Orphan girl was nowhere to be seen. Ronan ducked low. He was quiet as rain under a root. He thought, bomb. And there it was, a Molotov cocktail, not very different from the one he'd thrown into the Mitsubishi. Three rocks jutted from the damp forest floor, only the tips visible, eroded teeth, mossy gums. The bottle was tipped between them. Ronan crept forward, closed his fingers around the dew-covered neck of the bottle. Te vidimos, Grey Warren. Whispered one of the trees. We see you, Grey Warren. He clenched his hand around the bomb. He felt the dream shifting, shifting. He exploded awake. Kavinsky was already back doing a line of coke off the dash. The light outside was dull and dead past twilight. His neck and chin were lit like a garden feature by the dash lights below. He wiped his nose. His already keen expression sharpened when he saw Ronan's dream object. Ronan was paralyzed, as usual, but he could see perfectly well what he'd just produced. A Molotov cocktail identical to those at the substance party. A t-shirt twisted and stuffed into a beer bottle full of gasoline. It looked just as it had in the dream, only now it was burning. The flame, beautiful and voracious, had chewed well down into the glass. The gasoline was slicked up the side, reaching for demolition. With a wild laugh, Kavinsky hit the window button with his elbow and seized the bomb. He hurled it into the dusk. The bottle only made it 2 yards before it exploded, shivering glass against the side of the Mitsubishi and in through the open window. The smell was terrific. An aerial battle. And the sound sucked all of the hearing out of Ronan's ears. Hanging his arm out the window and looking profoundly unconcerned, Kavinsky shook glass shards off his skin and into the grass. 2 seconds later and he wouldn't have had any arms to worry about. Ronan wouldn't have had a face. Hey, Ronan said, don't touch my stuff. Kavinsky turned his heavy-lidded eyes to Ronan, eyebrows raised.
Check it.
He lifted his dream thing. A framed diploma. Joseph Kavinsky graduated from Aglenby Academy with honors. Ronan hadn't seen one to know if the creamy paper was correct or if the wording was accurate, but he recognized the spattered signature from Aglenby correspondence. President Bell's artistic scrawl was unmistakable. It was badly against Ronan's code to be impressed, much less show it, but the accuracy and detail was striking.
You're too emotional, Lynch, Kavinsky said. It's okay, I get it. If you had balls, it'd be different.
He tapped his temple.
This is a Walmart. Just go to electronics, swipe some TVs, get out of there. Don't wallow around in there. This would help.
He gestured to the powder still dusting the dash. Barely there, a fine memory of powder. Ronan shook his head. He could feel Gansey's eyes on him.
Suit yourself.
Kavinsky retrieved another six-pack from the back seat.
Ready to go?
And they dreamt. They dreamt and dreamt. And the stars wheeled overhead and away, and the moon hid in the trees and the sun moved around the car. The car filled with impossible gadgets and stinging plants, singing stones and lacy bras. As the noon boiled down, they climbed out and stripped their sweaty shirts and dreamt in the heat instead. Things too big to be contained in a car. Again and again, Ronan punched into the forest in his fraying dreams, snuck between the trees, stole something. He was beginning to understand what Kavinsky meant. The dream was a byproduct in all of this. Sleep was irrelevant. The trees were just obstacles, a sort of faulty alarm system. Once he short-circuited that, he could take things from his mind without worrying about the dream itself corrupting them. The light stretched long and thin, nearly to breaking, and then there was night with its tantalizing reflections off 100 white cars.
Ronan didn't know if it had been days or if this was the same night as before. How long ago had he wrecked the pig? When was his last nightmare? Then it was a morning. He didn't know if they'd already done a morning or if this was a brand new one. The grass was wet and the Mitsubishi's hoods were beaded sweatily, but it was hard to tell if it had rained or if it was merely dew. Ronan sat against the rear fender of one of the Mitsubishis, the smooth surface cool against his bare back, and wolfed Twizzlers. They felt as if they floated in alcohol inside him. Kavinsky was inspecting Ronan's latest piece of work, a chainsaw. After he'd satisfied himself at work by mutilating some of the tires on the other Mitsubishis, he rejoined Ronan and accepted a single Twizzler. He was too high for food to be very interesting as anything besides a concept. Well, Ronan asked. Chainsawing had blasted little flecks of rubber across Kavinsky's face and bare chest. He said, "No, you dream the Camaro." 44. Now it seemed simple. Pill, beer, dream. A Camaro sat among the trees of the dream forest. No more difficult to imagine than any of the other dream objects Ronan had pursued, just larger. In, out. Silently, he put his hand on the door handle. The leaves of the trees shivered above. A bird sobbed distantly. Orphan girl watched from the other side of the car. She shook her head. He put his finger to his lips. Awake. He opened his eyes on the morning sky, and there it was, a glory red Camaro. Not perfect, but perfectly imperfect, smudged and scuffed as the pig, down to the scratch on the door where Gansey had backed it into an azalea bush. The first sensation wasn't joy, but relief. He had not ruined things. He had the pig back. He could return to Monmouth without begging. And then the joy hit. It was worse than Kavinsky's green pills. He was hurled into the emotion. It pummeled and thrilled him. He'd been so proud of the puzzle box, of the sunglasses, the keys. How stupid he'd been then, like a kid in love with his crayon drawings. This was a car. An entire car. It hadn't been there, and now it was. An entire world. Now it would be all right. Everything would be all right. From the front of the car, Kavinsky sounded unimpressed. He'd lifted the hood.
I thought you said you fucking knew this car, man.
After Ronan's limbs had feeling in them again, he joined Kavinsky by the open hood. The defect was immediately apparent. There was no engine. Ronan could see all the way to the stubbled grass. It would probably run, of course. If it worked in the dream, it worked in real life, but that was no comfort. I didn't think of it, he said. The engine. The joy was fading as quickly as it had appeared. How could Ronan hope to hold all of the pig's foibles in his head? Gansey wouldn't want a perfect pig, a pig that ran sans engine. He would want his pig. He loved the Camaro because it broke down, not despite it. Despair rang in Ronan's thoughts. It was too complicated. Kavinsky abruptly punched the side of Ronan's head.
Think! There's no thinking, fool! We're not professors! Kill your brain!
He surveyed the empty engine compartment again.
I guess Dick can use this as a planter. Put his petunias and shit in here.
Irritated, Ronan slammed the hood shut. He climbed onto it, no point to sparing the paint from scratches, and flicked his fingers against his knee while he tried to get his mind back together. No thinking. Ronan didn't know a better way to get the car from his dreams. He didn't understand how to hold the concept inside him as he was thrust into sleep. He was weary of his dreams. They felt as tattered as the night horror's wings.
Hey, man, I'm sure he'll like this one. Kavinsky said, and if he doesn't, fuck him.
Ronan merely leveled his heaviest gaze. Kavinsky was not Gansey, so maybe he didn't understand its meaning. There would be no fucking of Gansey.
Ronan hadn't intended to wreck the Camaro when he'd first taken it, but he had. He wasn't going to add insult to injury by bringing back this imposter. This car was not a truth. This car was a very pretty lie. This, Ronan said, pressing his hands flat against the warm metal of the car, is a very shitty goldfish.
Whose fault is that?
Yours. Kavinsky had said he'd teach him. He was not taught.
Yours! I practiced, man!
Kavinsky gestured broadly to the field of Mitsubishis.
You see all these losers? It took me months to get it right. Look at that bitch!
He pointed to one with a single axle right in the middle. The car rested sleepily on its front bumper.
I get it wrong? Try it again. Wait for my dream place to get its juice back. Do it again. Get it wrong. Do it again.
Ronan repeated, What do you mean, get your juice back?
The dream place runs out, Kavinsky said. Walmart can't keep making TVs all night long.
It's getting low now. Can't you feel it? Was that what he felt? The fraying around the edges? Right now he could only feel anxiety dulled to stupidity by beer. I don't have time to practice. I need it now or I can't go back.
Kavinsky said, You don't have to go back.
This was the most nonsensical thing he'd said since this entire experience had begun. Ronan didn't even acknowledge it. He said, I'm doing it again. I'm doing it right this time.
Hell yeah, you are.
Kavinsky retrieved yet more alcohol. Maybe he'd been dreaming that, too, and joined Ronan on the hood of the faulty Camaro. They drank in silence for several minutes. Kavinsky poured a handful of green pills into Ronan's palm. Ronan pocketed them. He wished passionately for something besides Twizzlers. He was wasted on dreams. If Gansey saw him now, the thought twisted and blackened in him, curled like burned paper.
Bonus round, Kavinsky said. Then, open.
He put an impossibly red pill on Ronan's tongue. Ronan tasted just an instant of sweat and rubber and gasoline on his fingertips. Then the pill hit his stomach. What's this one do? Ronan asked.
Kavinsky said, Dying's a boring side effect.
It took only a moment. Ronan thought, Wait, I changed my mind. But there wasn't any going back. Ronan was a stranger in his own body. The sunset cut into his gaze, slantwise and insistent. As his muscles twitched, he lowered himself onto his chest and then rested his cheek against the hood, the heat of the metal not quite painful enough to be unbearable. He closed his eyes. This wasn't the hurtling to sleep pill of before. This was a liquid fatality. He could feel his brain shutting down. After a moment, he heard the hood groan as Kavinsky leaned over him. Then he felt the ridged callus of a finger drag slowly over the skin on his back, a slow arc between his shoulder blades, drawing the pattern of his tattoo, then sliding down his spine, tensing every muscle it moved over. The fuse inside him was burning to nothing, nothing at all. Ronan didn't move. If he moved, the touch on his spine would stab him. A wound like this pill. No coming back. But when his eyes slitted, battling sleep, Kavinsky was just doing another line of coke off the roof, body stretched over the windshield. He might have imagined it. What was real? Again, the Camaro was parked in the dreaming trees. Again, orphan girl crouched on the other side of it, eyes sad. The leaves quivered and faded. He felt this place's power dissipating. He crept toward the car. In, out.
Ronan, whispered Orphan Girl. Quit furantur a nos.
Why do you steal from us? She was faded as Noah, smudgy as the dead. Ronan whispered, Just one more, please. She stared at him. Unum, amabote. It's not for me. In, out. But he didn't hide this time. He wasn't a thief. Instead, he stood, rising from his hiding place. The dream, suddenly aware, shuddered around him, flickered. The trees leaned away. He hadn't stolen Chainsaw, the truest thing he'd ever taken from a dream.
He wasn't going to steal the car. Not this time. Please, Ronan said again. Let me take it. He ran his hand across the elegant line of the roof. When he lifted his palm, it was dusted green. His heart thudded as he rubbed pollen-covered fingertips against one another. The air was suddenly hot, sweat sticky in the crease of his elbows, gasoline pricking his nostrils. This was a memory, not a dream. He pulled open the door. When he got in, the seat burned his bare skin. He was aware of everything around him, down to the scuffed vinyl beneath the improperly restored window cranks. He was lost in time. Was he sleeping? Call it by name, said Orphan Girl. Camaro, Ronan said. Pig. Ganges. Cabe's water. Please. He turned the key. The engine turned, 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 finicky as it had always been. It was as real as anything had ever been. When it caught, he woke up. Kavinsky grinned in the windshield at him. Ronan sat in the driver's seat of the pig. Air sputtered in the air conditioning vents, scented with gasoline and exhaust. Ronan didn't have to look under the hood to know that the thundering he felt in his feet came from a proper engine. Yes, yes, yes. Also, he thought he knew why Cabe's water had disappeared, which meant he might know how to get it back, which meant he might get his mother back, which meant he might make Matthew smile for a little while longer, which meant he had something besides a restored car to bring back to Ganzi. He rolled down the window. I'm going. For a moment, Kavinsky's face was perfectly blank, and then Kavinsky flickered back onto it. He said, You're shitting me. I'll send flowers. Ronan revved at the engine. Exhaust and dust swirled in a wild torment behind the Camaro. It coughed at 2800 RPM, just like the pig. Everything was back the way it was.
Running back to your master?
This was fun, Ronan said. Time for big boy games now, though.
You're a player in his life, Lynch.
The difference between us and Kavinsky, Ganzi whispered in Ronan's head, is we matter.
You don't fucking need him,
Kavinsky said. Ronan released the parking brake. Kavinsky threw up a hand like he was going to hit something, but there was nothing but air.
You are shitting me!
I never lie, Ronan said. He frowned disbelievingly. This felt like a more bizarre scenario than anything that had happened to this point. Wait, you thought it was never going to be you and me. Is that what you thought? Kavinsky's expression was scorched.
There's only with me or against me.
Which was ludicrous. It had always been Ronan against Kavinsky. There was never any possibility of with. It was never going to be you and me.
I will burn you down, Kavinsky said.
Ronan's smile was sharp as a knife. He had already been burned to nothing. You wish. Kavinsky made a gun of his thumb and finger and put it to Ronan's temple.
Bang, he said softly, withdrawing the fake gun. See you on the streets.
45. So now Adam had a car. The vehicle was but one of three objects Adam had acquired that morning. As each of the other Ganzes had gone out the door, they'd all bestowed a gift, eccentric fairy godmothers. Richard Ganzi II checked his tie in a hallway mirror and handed Adam a checked vest.
I'm not as thin as I used to be, he told Adam. I was going to give this to Dick, but it will suit you better, I think. Here, put it on.
It was not even a gift, it was an order.
Next was Mrs. Ganzi peering out the window to verify that her driver was out front before saying, Dick, I've gotten you another mint plant to take back. Don't forget it. Adam, I picked you up a rubber plant, too. You boys never think about feng shui.
He knew it was because they had retrieved him pathetically from the side of an interstate, but he didn't feel he could refuse. It was a plant, and he had ruined their Saturday. Gone, he thought. He'd ruined their Saturday. But he'd entirely lost his Saturday.
Whatever made him Adam had just vanished while his body shambled on. If he let himself think about it, the terror just... it wouldn't happen again. It couldn't. As the boys were headed out the door, Gansey holding his tiny mint plant and Adam struggling beneath a 5-gallon pot of rubber tree, Helen came down dragging a tiny black-wheeled suitcase. "Dick," she said, "those guys from the tow place said they couldn't come this morning. Could you please take care of it before you go? I'm going to miss my flight." Gansey, who already looked terse, increased the irritation on his face to officially harassed. "Does it run? Can we just drop it off?" "It runs, I guess. But it's in Herndon, the drop-off." "Herndon?" "I know, that's why I was having it towed. It's costing me more to get it there than I'm getting to donate it." "Hey, do you have any need for it?" "Adam, you want a piece of shit car? Save me the tow?" The offer felt imaginary. Consciousness was being played on a movie screen. 3 Gansies, 3 gifts, and 3 hours back to Henrietta. "Don't let me lose control on the way home," Adam thought. "Just give me back, that's all I ask." His new car was of uncertain make and model year. It was a 2-door something and smelled of automotive body fluids. The hood, passenger side door, and right rear fender were clearly from 3 entirely different cars. It was a stick shift. Adam was in the peculiar position of knowing how to rebuild a clutch better than how to operate one, but he'd get better with practice. It was nothing, but it was Adam Parrish's nothing. This day, this place, this life. It felt like he'd always been here in D.C., born in the simmering asphalt petri dish of the city. He'd dreamt Henrietta and Aglenby. It was taking everything in him to remember that there was a future beyond this immediate moment. "Just get back," he thought. "Get back so you can find out." "Look, just flash your lights if something goes wrong," Gansey said, standing before the open door of his black Suburban. He ordinarily kept it here, but no one really trusted Adam's new vehicle to make the drive across the state. Gansey rocked the driver's side door a little. Adam could tell that he wanted nothing more than to ask, "Are you all right?" or "What do you need, Adam?" The mint plant, placed on the dash, peered anxiously around Gansey's shoulder. "Don't," Adam warned, a frown, angrier than the night before last. "You don't even know what I was going to say." "It's possible I did." Gansey swung the door another time. The Suburban was huge behind him. Adam's new car and the pig would fit inside it with room for a bicycle or two. Adam remembered how breathtaking its existence had been when he first learned of it. Rich enough for 2 cars. "What was I going to say then?" The power lines shivered above Adam. Something was singing and shaking inside him. He needed to get back. Soon. That was all he knew. Adam said, "I don't think we should do this now." "Are we doing something now? I thought what was happening was that you were being..." With visible effort, Gansey checked himself. "Are you coming back to Monmouth, or..." "No time. No time for that." He needed to stop waiting and start acting. He was no better than Gansey, hoping for someone else to wake the ley line. He needed to move. "I'm going to Fox Way to ask for advice," Adam replied. Gansey opened his mouth. There were 100 things he could say, and 99 of them would only make Adam angry. Gansey seemed to intuit this because he took his time before he said, "I'll check up on Ronan then." Adam sank into the worn and dusty seat of his new old car. Whispers escaped from the air vents. "Fine. I'm coming. I'm coming." Gansey was still staring at Adam, but what did he want him to say? It was taking everything in him to remember who he was. "Just flash your lights," Gansey said finally, "if something goes wrong." 46. When Maura opened the door of 300 Fox Way, she found the gray man standing pensively on the other side. He had brought her 2 things, a daisy chain crown, which he somberly placed on her head, and a pink switchblade, which he handed to her. Both had taken some effort to procure. The first, because the gray man had forgotten how to efficiently link daisies, and the second, because switchblades were illegal in Virginia, even if they were pink.
I've been looking for something, the gray man said. I know. I thought it was a box. I know. It's not, is it? Mora shook her head. She stepped back to let him in. Drink? The gray man didn't immediately step inside. Is it a person? She held his gaze. She repeated, drink? With a sigh, he followed her in. She led him down the main hallway to the kitchen, where she badly made him a drink and then led him onto the back patio. Kala and Persephone were already positioned in chairs arranged where the shaggy lawn gave way to new puddles and old bricks. They looked ethereal and pleased in the long golden afternoon sunshine that had emerged after the storm. Persephone's hair was a white cloud. Kala's was three different colors of purple. Mr. Gray, Kala said, expansive and scathing. She assassinated a mosquito on her calf and then eyed the glass in Mora's hand. I can tell already that drink's shit. Mora looked at it sadly. How can you tell? Because you made it. Straightening the daisy chain on her head, Mora patted the remaining chair and sat on the bricks beside it. The gray